Hey, everybody, it's Andy. Welcome back to the Decatur City Church Podcast. At the end of this episode, we would love it if you would take just a moment to download the Decatur City Church app, where you can find access to all of our recent message content. And the app is the easiest way to share this content with a friend. But most importantly, I hope you enjoy the following presentation, and I hope it inspires you to take your next step in your faith journey.
Well, before we jump into our content for today, a bit of housekeeping before we start. I often get the question, what's the deal with the chalkboard? Is this like a security blanket for you? Can you talk without writing and drawing pictures on a chalkboard? And I don't know quite how to answer the question all the time. I don't know always what's behind the question, but here's my standard answer. So you don't have to ask me in case you've ever wondered. The standard answer is I grew up in church and my dad was a pastor. I was a PK. So if you know PKs, you know pastor's kids. All of it's true. I was one of those. And growing up in church, to keep me out of trouble in church, my mom would let me take the bulletin and I would grab a pencil like I'm going to take notes. You know, there's a notes page. We used to pass out a bulletin in church if you didn't grow up in church. It's like a piece of paper that told you what was going to happen in the service. Some of you are thinking, that'd be nice to have now. Like, I don't know what's coming next in the service. But I would turn it over to the notes page and I would draw pictures during the whole service and not pay attention. And the irony is now I draw pictures in church so that you will pay attention. So I've kind of always been drawing and writing in church. So that's what I'm doing as a part of preaching today. So I hope you'll enjoy the chalkboard. And if you don't, we're going to do it anyway. So I'm thrilled to continue in this series. We began this series with a question, and it's sort of a fill-in-the-blank question. And if you've not thought of this before, this is something our team was thinking about. We're just thinking, like, what do we do next? This is several months ago. What do we do next? What comes next in this series of messages that we do at our church? And one of the questions that came up was, what does our world, and so what does our world need? And so the question or the fill-in-the-blank was, our world needs now is what? Like, if you were the person filling in the blank, what would you say our world needs now? And there's probably as many different answers as people linked with us at our various locations around Atlanta, our partners across the country and around the world, people streaming online, people who are watching this a different day. We have all sorts of answers to this. Here's a couple of mine. I know you didn't ask, but I'm going to tell you anyway because I have the microphone. We don't need more of the same, I don't think. And I don't think we need more of the past. I don't think we need more arguing. I don't think we need more promises. We've had a lot of all of that stuff. But what's interesting is, regardless of what you think we need more, the Apostle Paul, we saw this in the first week, he had an interesting answer to this. And the Apostle Paul would say, what the world needs more of is it needs more of you. And it needs more of me. It needs more of us. Us as Jesus followers, but not the current version of you. And not the current version of me. It needs a grown-up version of us. It needs people, as Paul said, people who are mature, people who are grown up, people who don't act like children, people who put childish ways behind them, people who refuse to bite and provoke, people who win the respect of outsiders, people who, and this is what we're talking about in this series, people who are led by the Holy Spirit. The truth is we all have work to do. We all have work to do to learn to become more mature, to be more led by God's Spirit in our lives. And what that produces, what that creates, we're more led by the Spirit, we become more Christ-like, become more like Christ, which is really what our world needs now. And so the question we're asking in this series is, what does Christ-like look like and act like and react like? Given the things we experience in our world, what does being more Christ-like look like, act like, and react like? And it's not a new to-do list. But it's the fruit of the Spirit, we've said. It's the fruit of, it's something produced through us. It's an outcome of our submission to God's Spirit within us. So this is produced through us. The first one, the fruit of the Spirit is love. And we talked about this in the first week. It's sort of the overarching idea for everything that comes after it. That all the fruit that come after this reflect God's love because they flow from God's Spirit. Last week, we looked significantly at joy at all of our locations. We talked about what does it look like for joy to be produced through our lives. The next in the list today that we're going to deal with is peace. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, and it's peace. Now, today I want to take a little different approach to start. Sometimes it's helpful to start by considering the opposite of something. And if we back up a few verses, this is verse 22. If we back up to verse 19 in chapter 5 of Galatians, we actually get what this is being contrasted with. There's a list of things that the fruit of the Spirit contrasted with, and it's the acts of the flesh. This is how verse 19 starts. It says the acts of the flesh, and then it gives a whole list. I'm just going to put a partial list up here, but two-thirds of the list, look what's included in two-thirds of the list. The act of the flesh is hatred and discord and jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions, and envy. As it turns out, the acts of the flesh produce a lack of peace, a deficiency of peace. Left to our own devices, on our own, not led by the Spirit, we bring about all sorts of things that are the opposite of peace in our world. Now, we often think of peace as the absence of these things. And when we think about peace, we think about it as the absence of conflict and the absence of war. But the biblical idea of peace, this is what I want to talk about today. The biblical idea of peace is not just the absence of something. It's the presence of something far greater. So I want to talk real quick, just an overview of this idea. The Hebrew word in the scriptures for peace, anybody know it? Shalom, yeah, good. And if you're Jewish, you know that as I'm writing this, I have to think about it while I'm writing this. If you're Jewish, you know I just wrote that backwards because Hebrew goes the other way around. But the Hebrew word for peace is shalom. And shalom is not just the absence of conflict and war. In fact, it, throughout the Old Testament, God's defining and he's trying to explain the type of life he wants his people to have. And it's a life of shalom. And he uses, this word is used in all sorts of different places to help us understand the fullness of the meaning of shalom. It's not just the absence of something. It's the presence of something else. God told Moses to build an altar. And when he told him to build an altar, he said, I want you to use a certain type of stones, only the uncut stones. No stones that were fractured or that had defects in them or cracks. I want you, and he was describing a specific characteristic. It's the characteristic of wholeness. I only want you to use stones that are whole, that are whole in their shape. When Solomon was finishing the temple, we're told, was finished when there were no gaps in the temple anymore. All the gaps in the walls of the temple were closed up. That's when we find out that the temple was complete. There's a completeness about shalom. This word is used in that context as well. In fact, this idea of no gaps being a shalom is something that has no gaps in it. It's also in Exodus. It's applied to reconciling relationships. A reconciled relationship is complete when there's no more gaps in the relationship. It's used in another context when Joseph was inquiring about his aging father, and when David was inquiring about his men that were out at war, trying to find out how they're doing. Both of them got reports back saying that they're alive and they're in a state of shalom. They're in a state of well-being. So the truth is God's shalom, God's peace, is not just the absence of conflict or discord or difficulty. It's the presence of wholeness and completeness and well-being. And what's interesting is the people of Israel were not good at this, and neither were their kings. They weren't good at attaining or maintaining shalom, and so they needed instruction after instruction, and they weren't good at internally in their own souls, and they weren't good at externally, not within their community or with people outside of them. They were constantly in conflict, and that's something we know about in our world. And that's why Isaiah, when he was talking about how God was going to deliver them from all of this conflict and turmoil, he told about a king. He told about a king that was coming. And we usually talk about this king at Christmas time. And usually these are verses that are talked about at Christmas. And he says that one's going to come after him, a final king, God's final king. And he's going to be a wonderful counselor. He'll be a mighty God. He'll be an everlasting father. And he'll be a prince of peace. He'll be the one that delivers and guards and guides the people into all peace. And so God's saying, like, you're going to have this future king, and he's going to come, and this is what you should experience. Now, on the other side of this, Jesus has come. We're in the world now. The Apostle Paul's talking about how do we lean into this Prince of Peace to experience peace in our lives. But before we get to that, the thing is beyond all the external conflict, which would be easy to list out and talk about, you know, the social, political, racial unrest we've experienced in our world, in our cities. The truth is that conflict, as easily it is seen, it's not what psychologists think is the most significant thing in our day. In fact, a lack of inner peace, most psychologists would say, is the greatest social concern of our day. The number of cases of anxiety has been on the rise, it's skyrocketing since about 2010. I recently read a book called The Anxious Generation, which I'd commend to all of you if you have kids. And in this, Jonathan Haidt talks about where this all came from and why it started to spike in 2010. Do you know that since 2010, among Gen X, which is my generation, anxiety has gone up 52% since 2010, the last 15 years. Among millennials, it's gone up 103%. Among Gen Z, which is like 18 to 25-year-olds, it's gone up 139%. It's growing at a rapid rate. In the most extensive study that was done last year of people who are experiencing anxiety, depressive disorder, the poll discovered that about 20% of 65 plus experience anxiety, depressive disorder. 50 to 64-year-olds, it's about 29% of the population. 25 to 49-year-olds, it's 38%. Among 18 to 24-year-olds, it's almost 1 in 2. 83 million plus adults in America reported experiencing anxiety, depressive disorder last year. Here's the truth, is we live in a world where we experience this at a rapid and increasing rate. It's not new, but we've been experiencing this in an increasing way for a while now. And if you're with us here in Atlanta, you're right there, by the way. But we're experiencing this an extraordinary clip. It's just growing like out of control. And so the question is, what do we do about it? How do we, as thoughtful Christians, interact with this in this world? And how do we deal with this? Because what our world definitely needs now is more peace, mainly inner peace. And I'm going to make the case that when you have inner peace, that moves outward, and you begin to experience that in the world around us. And the New Testament followers of Jesus, they were actually given some instructions, some very specific instructions, and they were living in the midst of chaos. I mean, it was way harder for them to live as a follower of Jesus in their day than it is in our day. That brought all sorts of chaos and conflict in and of itself as they were warring, and even the Roman powers that be were in conflict and trying to suppress this movement of Jesus followers. And this is what the Apostle Paul says. This is his instructions for them as to how to deal with this. He says, "Do not be anxious about anything." Any questions? It's like, what? Like, that's impossible. I mean, I don't even think this is possible. Like you, what do you mean? Do not be anxious about anything. You can't just stop being anxious. It's not like I decided, I think I'm going to be anxious today. Like, we just, that's not how it works, Paul. And before I lose you, I just want you to say, this is one of those places where this gets lost in translation. Upon further investigation, this is actually so helpful. I want to unpack this for just a minute. This is a Greek word. We're in the New Testament now. So this is a Greek word. And the Greek word, merimna. I don't normally write in Greek, guys, so give me a second. Merimna, it's a little hard to say. This Greek word, merimna, it's essentially anti-shalom. Everything about it is the opposite of shalom. And when you discover what this word means, this first part, Mary, I left the I out. Mary, this is the word where we get the word meridian. And meridian, you know, it separates the earth like this. It divides. Mary and mind or soul or spirit. So this is what happens. The description of this word, while it's translated anxious here, it means to be divided in your inner being. It can also mean to have a fractured heart. Somebody's hurt you, or somebody's betrayed you, or something's done something to you, and it's fractured, it's hurt your heart. Or it can also mean to be pulled apart in terms of your will. So you can be divided in your mind, or fractured in your heart, or pulled apart in your will. And you can see it's the exact opposite of shalom. And this is why it's the command. Like, you don't want to be a part of this. In fact, what the Apostle Paul is saying, he's essentially saying, don't let anything pull you apart. Don't let anything divide you or tear you apart on the inside. And the reason is, and if you think about this for a second, if you think about this, when you have a divided mind, or you have a fractured heart, or you're being pulled apart and pulled in two directions in terms of what should I do, you're far more vulnerable and fragile. You know this. Because you don't feel confident, you don't feel whole, you don't feel well. And you're more vulnerable and you're more fragile. And when we're more vulnerable and fragile, we're more easily persuaded, we're more easily manipulated, we're more easily controlled. We've all seen this happen in our world. In fact, you've heard it said that nothing divides like politics. And we've seen, in terms of the social unrest in our world, we've experienced in recent years a massive amounts of that, and it's a climate that's ripe for division. And we've seen the division, the fracturing of families, of friendships, of communities, of organizations, even churches. We've seen this happen. And the reason nothing divides like politics is because nothing divides like fear. See, fear is actually at the root of it. Fear is what pulls us apart. It's what divides us. It's what fractures us. And it starts on the inside. And when we become more vulnerable and more unsure of ourselves and more fragile, we're easily pulled in directions that we wouldn't normally be pulled. We're easily controlled and manipulated. And then the question we begin to ask ourselves is, well, who should I trust? And you got a group over here on the left that's trying to get your attention over here, and a group over here that's on your right. And the Apostle Paul's going, don't look left, don't look right, look up. Look up, because the truth is you're looking to people who actually can't control. They don't have the power. The question we're asking is, who do we give the power to? Who are we gonna put our hope in? I just gotta tell you this today. No election has ever solved this in the history of the world. Not one. It's never been solved. And the reason is because our votes do not result in the sovereign control of the world. Somebody may think it does. It doesn't result in sovereign control of the world or of your life. That job is already taken. The Apostle Paul says, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. So whatever's pulling your heart or your mind or your marriage or your family apart, whatever's robbing you of your shalom, of your wholeness, of your completeness, of your well-being, you should take this to the authority on peace. It's not who you think it is. It's not the people who are making promises to you. It's not the people who are arguing with each other. There's one person that can deliver that to you, and you're not gonna vote for him. He doesn't need your vote. Now, this doesn't mean you don't give up caring about it. Doesn't mean you don't care about it anymore. It means you're gonna hand it over. You're gonna entrust it. That's the key word. You're gonna entrust it to someone who cares about it, and it cares about you even more than you could possibly imagine. And you're gonna, not only do they care about you, and they care, and they see you, and they know you, you're gonna hand it over to someone who has the ability to do something about it, the ability to intervene in your life. My brother and I were traveling back from visiting a bunch of our partners in Australia, which was an amazing trip last year, and we're on our way back, and we had a layover in LA on our way back, and it was a 3-hour layover, and we were eager to get home. We've been gone a long time. You know, the flights are really long. We're traveling. My brother's like, hey, I just found out there's a flight that's 2 hours earlier. We can make the connection. Call and change your flight. He's like, I already called and changed mine. So I call, and I get somebody, and they're like, I'm sorry, we can't do that for you. I mean, we could change it, but you have to rebook the ticket. It's like thousands of dollars. I'm like, well, I'm not doing that. And so I was like, you know, I did whatever you would do. When you get a no from somebody, you say, can I talk to your supervisor? And so I got the supervisor and I talked to the supervisor and the supervisor said, yeah, I'm sorry, you can't do that. I mean, I can offer you, I can get you the ticket. I can get you on that flight, but here's what it's going to cost. And I was like, can I talk to your supervisor? And I went on and, you know, I did the same thing. I finally got to the person who just said, hey, listen, there's nobody else to talk to. You've talked to everybody and you can't just get this flight changed. And so I texted my brother. We weren't together at the moment. I texted him. I said, hey, listen, I talked to everybody. I can't, they're not going to change my flight. I can't get on that flight. Less than 5 minutes later, he texted me back. He said, it's changed. So I call him like, what? Like, how did you change the flight? My brother's a Delta loyalist. He's Delta 360. If you know what that is, he's got his own person. When he answers, they say his name. And so, like, he called him and said, hey, I need to get my brother in this flight. We're changing. And they're like, no problem. Here you go, Mr. Thomas. And he texted me back and said, it's done. I'm like, that is not fair. But he's earned it. Here's the difference. You don't have to earn your way up to gaining access to the highest authority on peace. It's offered to you. It's already been given to you. You've already been invited. You've been told in every situation by prayer and petition with thanksgiving, bring it to me, God says. Bring me your requests. In exchange, the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Have you ever seen this before? This peace of God that transcends all understanding. You see some people in a situation and circumstances and you're like, they're not normal. I don't know what's going on with them, but their world is chaos. And it's this peace and you're like, it's counterintuitive. It's illogical. It's nonsensical. And the reason is because it's not circumstantial. You've seen this. Some of you have seen this at funerals. I've done lots of funerals. And it's the difference between celebration and devastation at a funeral. When people grieve with hope, they can celebrate a life well lived. When people grieve without hope, there's devastation. When you're uncertain about what's next. I had an opportunity to do a funeral not long ago for an amazing lady who took care of my kids. She was a preschool teacher for a lot of our staff kids. She took care of my kids when they were little, invested in them, taught them. She was an amazing lady. She for decades, she took care of, invested in our children, our staff children. And she wanted me to do her funeral when she first was diagnosed with brain cancer. She asked me, she said, Joel, I'm not going to survive from this. They've already told me, I want you to do my funeral. Will you do my funeral? And I was like, sure, I'll do your funeral. So I was spending some time with her just before she died. And, you know, she asked for some time, just me and her and the rest of the family. And she'd been in and out, but she was particularly lucid in this moment. And I said, Kathy, so you've wanted me to do your funeral for so long. What do you want me to say to people? She goes, three things. I was like, okay, simple. Like I pulled out my pen. I'm like, give them to me. She goes, first, I want you to say, tell everybody who helped me get through this struggle and this difficulty in my life, I just want you to tell them thank you. From the bottom of my heart, I couldn't have done it without them. So many people showed up for me and my family. I'm so, so grateful. Second thing she said, I want you to tell everybody I'm fine. I'm more than fine. In fact, I'm better off than you are. It's exactly what she said to me. I'm better off than you are because I'm in heaven now and everything's perfect. And my life is so much better than yours. And I just want you to know that so you don't worry about me. I was like, I'll tell him, Kathy. She said, number three, she said, tell them that they're going to need to comfort and remind each other of the reality of heaven and what's ahead of them. And she said it so matter of fact. She was like, they're going to need to encourage each other. They're going to need to care for one another and lift one another up in this season. And it was the difference between somebody who was absolutely confident. She had this peace. I'm like, you're days away from taking your last breath. And she's just, confidence can be. She had this peace. And it didn't make sense. But she had it. There's a second step in this process, Paul tells us. It's not just entrusting. It is entrusting. But the second step in the process is to shift our mind. And whatever is true and whatever is noble and whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things is what we're told. No one just stops worrying about things. That's why the beginning part we want to just dismiss, because you can't just stop worrying. Like nobody stops a bad habit. You have a bad habit? You can't just stop a bad habit. It has to be replaced, right? You have to trade one thing for another. You have to trade what you're currently dwelling on for something better, for something more helpful, for something more beneficial. Did you know, and this is why this is so difficult, did you know that you're psychologically predisposed to pay attention to bad news? You're psychologically predisposed to pay attention to things that are harmful and difficult and wrong in the world. And this is why these things get our attention. And the reason they do is because we were psychologically predisposed for survival. That's why you pay attention to those things more. And not only that, but today in our world, because of this little thing we carry around in our hand, it's far more accessible and you're far more exposed to bad news than you ever have been in your life. Bad news travels and it sells and it controls and it follows you everywhere you go. And nature causes you to want to look at it and pay attention to it. And many times, this is the thing that's amazing, many times what you're hearing and seeing is not a realistic picture. It's not reality. It's not what's really going on in the world. Several years ago, I read a book called Factfulness. Some of you have maybe seen this book. And the author set out to help people understand that the picture you're getting of the world is not reality. He lists out 10 different things about how the world is extremely better than it used to be. And I'll just, as a couple examples, he said that those living in extreme poverty in the 1800s, about 85% of the world was living in extreme poverty. In 1994, jumping ahead, about 35% of the world lived in extreme poverty. In 2022, 8% of the world lives in extreme poverty. That's not what you're being told, though. That's not what you're being sold. And it's because that doesn't sell. That doesn't get your attention. But you're being told and you're being sold on a narrative that allows, when you're weak in your inner being, it allows others to control you. Natural disasters. This is a big one. People talk about how bad the natural disasters are today. Do you know in the early 1900s, roughly 325,000 people annually lost their lives through natural disasters. The loss of life in the early 2000s annually is only about 80,000 people. And that's not what you're being told. That's not what you're being sold. The truth is the world is verifiably safer and richer. There's more opportunity than there ever has been. Now, I'm not sticking my head in the sand. We got problems. We got issues. But it's not what you're being sold every day. You're being controlled and you've got people trying to get you to dwell on the bad stuff. The Apostle Paul's going, no. You gotta take those thoughts captive. And you got to shift your mind to the things that are good and the things that are right and the things that are true. And when you do, the peace of God will be with you. His peace will follow you around. It'll accompany you. It'll take up residence inside of you. Now, some of you are wanting to dismiss this. You're going, oh, this is like another message on the power of positive thinking or a Jedi mind trick or something like that, like whatever. And don't dismiss this. Listen, be thoughtful. Science has proven this. You ready? I mean, some of you know I like neuroscience. Let me nerd out for just a second. And don't check out, because this is so important. Two recent discoveries within the last 100 years, which is very recent. Two recent discoveries. The first, neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity, you're like, what is that? 1948, we discovered that the physical matter of the brain changes continuously. Prior to 1948, we thought it was fixed. We thought your IQ was fixed. We thought nothing changed in the brain. The brain you have, the capacity you have, that's it. 1948, we discovered it's not true. The brain is constantly changing. It's changing its capacity. The synapse, the gray matter of your brain, it changes continuously. Then in 1998, neurogenesis. Neurogenesis was discovered. And neurogenesis is simply this. Every day, do you know this? Every day you wake up and your brain generates new brain cells. New baby moldable brain cells that are ready to be shaped. They haven't been impacted. They're ready to be shaped by the thoughts that are coming into your mind. Do you know this? The primary change agent for the brain cells that you were born with and the brain cells that get generated every day, do you know it's not your environment? It's not food. It's not nutrients. It's not other substances. The primary change agent for your brain is your thoughts. That's not Bible speak. That's neuroscience. Thoughts change the physical nature of the brain. And nobody saw this coming. No one saw this coming in their research. Dr. Herbert Benson, the chief of mind, body, and medicine at Harvard, he said that negative thoughts actually obstruct the body's natural healing processes. It obstructs your body to reinstate shalom within your physical body, not just your emotions. In your physical body, negative thoughts do that. Nobody saw that coming. The science verifies, though, something the Apostle Paul said when he was talking about this same idea to a different group of people in Rome. In 56 AD, we didn't discover all this till the mid and late 1900s, 56 AD in the first century. This is what the Apostle Paul said. He said, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Don't be conformed. Don't let your body, don't let yourself be transformed or be conformed to the environment that you're in, but be transformed by the things that you think. Do you know we're all engaged in a formation process every minute of every day? This isn't a religious thing. It's a scientific thing. It's a human thing. You're being formed and you're being shaped. The inputs that are coming into your life, the things that you read, the things that you see, the thoughts that get shaped of that, they're conforming you. They're shaping who you are. This is my best explanation of what I think the Apostle Paul is teaching in these verses. He says, look, you live in an environment, and if you're not careful, you'll be conformed to the inputs in the environment that you have, whether they're right or true or not. You're going to be conformed by that. But instead of that, this is what he said. Instead of that, when you have those anxious thoughts, those things that divide you and those things that pull you apart, entrust them. And don't just entrust them to anyone. Entrust them to somebody who can carry them, somebody who can do something about it. Entrust them to the Prince of Peace. And not only that, once you entrust those to the Prince of Peace, then you need to trade them and trust and trade and trust and trade and trust and trade those things as you present them. You take on the things that are good and that are right and that are true, the things that'll bring about shalom in your life. And that's how we are transformed. That's how our world is transformed. That's how you and I go from people who are divided, who are fractured, who are pulled apart, to people who experience wholeness and completeness and well-being. And it takes intentionality. It takes an active participation on our part to renew our mind so we experience this shalom. Several years ago, my wife and I, some of you know the story, so I won't tell the details. We went and took a heart assignment. We weren't looking for it. We weren't looking to leave. We were here 17 years as part of this church and organization. I thought it was the greatest church in the world. We lived in a neighborhood with my brother and my sister and their kids. Our kids went on the school bus together to school, and we didn't think life could get better. And God called us to the desert, literally to the desert. And we moved to Arizona, to Phoenix, and we didn't know anybody. We didn't feel like we had anybody surrounding us to do that with us. And it was hard. It was a hard thing we felt like God led us toward. And after being there for a while, when I first got there, it was a bad situation, a difficult situation in the church. The church was in a big church, in a free fall. And I think it flattened out for just a minute. They were like, oh, who's the new guy? And then they figured out who I was. And they're like, okay, it's just going to keep going this way. And I mean that in all truth. That's exactly what happened. And when we got near the bottom, which thank goodness there was a bottom, when we got near the bottom in that season, I remember one particular night, my wife would often tell me, hey, listen, because I was bad about coming home and talking about how terrible things are, and I just dump on her all the time. I remember one time she was like, hey, listen, don't come home unless you've gone to the gym first. Like, you just need to go to the gym, work off some of the stress, whatever, like, then come home. I'll have dinner ready, you know, we'll have a nice evening together. So this was a particular busy day, and I went to the gym, got home, we were getting dinner, we had kids' activities, whatever, got everybody in bed finally, we're laying in bed, and I remember we were just quiet, and I think she probably was like, I probably need to ask him how his day was. In that season, she didn't ask me, did you have a good day? She knew I didn't have a good day. She said, how was your day? And I laid there quiet. I could not think of one good thing to say. Not one. After a few minutes laying there, what felt like a few minutes, this hot thought came into my mind. I've never heard the audible voice of God, but this thought came into my mind. It was, I was obedient today. That's a good thing. I did the next right thing. That season, I was sort of like, okay, God, this is, I mean, I didn't want to come here. Like, I had no experience in turnaround. I thought, if this whole thing crashes and burns and we go out of business and we have to sell the building and all that stuff, this is on you, Lord. This isn't on me. I didn't decide this. You're the one who chose me. Like, this, the outcome is on you. And I remember that night when I said that out loud, I was like, I was obedient to you. I thought, why is that so bad? That's actually a good answer. It was my only answer, but it felt good in the moment. I remember the next night, we were laying in bed and it was quiet and she didn't even ask me a question. And I said out loud, I was like, I was obedient today. It was the first time I slept well in months. In months. The peace of God. The outcomes hadn't changed. The peace of God began to guard my heart and my mind. And I experienced his peace. Telling you, there's no Jedi mind tricks. Jesus, the Prince of Peace, he promised his gift of peace to you and to me. He said this, I'm leaving. I'm leaving, but I'm leaving you with a gift, peace of mind and heart. And the peace I give is a gift the world cannot give. My well-being, my wholeness, my completeness, you can't get it from the world. But I'll give it to you. I'll give it to you. If you'll entrust to me what's dividing you and fracturing you and pulling you apart, if you'll entrust that to me and trade it for what's good and what's right and what's true, I'll give you my peace. This exchange is trading whatever's pulling you apart for the shalom of Jesus that puts us back together. It restores well-being and wholeness and completeness. And this is how we experience the fruit. This is how it's produced in us. It's how we experience the fruit of peace. Don't be conformed to the image of this world. Entrust and trade. Give it to me. Think on what's good and what's right and what's true. And be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Your whole being be transformed. Your whole life be transformed. What does our world need now? It needs this gift. It needs you. It needs me. It needs us. Not the current version of us. Because in many respects, we're no better off. We're no further ahead. It needs a more Christ-like version of us. A more peace-filled version of us. That's what it means to be Christ-like. That's what Christ-like looks like and acts like and reacts like. And it's not just what our world needs now. It's what many of us need now. I don't know what you walked in. I don't know what you walked in carrying today. But here's the offer on the table. Trade whatever's pulling you apart. Whatever's divided, fractured you. For the shalom that Jesus offers you. The wholeness, the completeness, the well-being. Jesus promised that gift to you. Let me pray for you. As we're praying, I just feel like I want to give somebody an opportunity to respond. Whether you're watching us online or whether you're in one of our buildings, whether you're here in this room, maybe just as I pray, you'd be willing to hold out your hands. And as you're doing, visualize in your hands that thing that's robbing you of your shalom, of robbing you of peace, the thing you're worried about, the thing that is out of your control, the thing you don't know is going to happen. Maybe it's relationally, maybe it's personally, maybe it's professionally. Maybe just think of a symbol and visualize that thing in your hands and then maybe you just lift it up a little bit in the spirit of being willing to entrust it to the Prince of Peace today. God, I pray for somebody who's here, who's carrying something. I pray by the power of your word and by the reality of your character that you would be faithful today to lift that symbolically, maybe supernaturally, lift that out of their hands today and help them to know that entrusting it to you is entrusting it to the only one who can care for it, care about it, and do something about it in their lives. The one who's most capable, most powerful, most suitable to carry it for them. And then I pray that you would bring to mind, bring into their mind things that they could replace that worry, that care, that anxiety, that difficulty, that brokenness inside of them, the angst that they felt, maybe the anger that they felt. Bring something to their mind that they could dwell on, they could fix their mind on, something that's good and right and true. And may today they walk out this door knowing they're walking back into circumstances that haven't changed. May they walk out the door with that peace that transcends all understanding, the peace that doesn't make sense because it's not circumstantial, but it's supernatural. I pray that you'd grant it to them today. And I pray it in Jesus' name.